Hello, hello, and welcome back to Brave Spill. I'm going to get Mel, I'm going to jump right into it. I'm going to do our intro before we start talking all over again. But anyway, welcome to Brave Space Live, where we're having tough conversations around anti-oppression, communal healing, and all of those things in an everyday way. I'm Tyshelle. I'm a diversity inclusion practitioner and a trained social worker, and this is my co-host.
Hey, I'm Mel. I'm an author and a social ethicist.
So I wanted to introduce our topic for today. So this is a topic I feel like is probably near and dear, as close to our first episode where we talked about friendships between Black and white women way, way back in the day. This is how we show up in the workplace, the glass, concrete, and bamboo ceiling, the glass cliff, the sticky floor. And folks, don't be worried about if you don't know those terms. We will define them, because that's the first part of having a conversation, knowing that we all have the same definitions or we're working from some sort of the same. So that's our topic. But I wanted to do a little shooting the shit. Mel and I haven't been on screen together or on the podcast, if you're listening to us, in like a month or so. I think it's been 4 weeks at least.
Been a while. Yeah. How you been?
Good, good. I wanted to ask you how your episode with Reverend Young Mi went.
Oh yeah, it was wonderful. Yeah, Young Mi is a hospice chaplain, and we talked about grief and death and dying, and Tyshelle was out that week, but you did an episode with
Joy Merrily.
Joy, that's right, on parenting, and that went well as well. I listened to that one too, and it was wonderful. So
it was, and I've started to like really look in, and I follow her content. She on TikTok, Joy Merrily. I follow her content, and she talks about parenting. She actually just, and I send it to, I don't currently have children, so I send her content when I find something that's not too, that sounds really communal, because you know, when you have friends who have kids, they definitely don't want to hear what you think about things, like especially in the midst of their parenting. So I send them her content, because it is so engaging and conversational and not like preachy to what you should and shouldn't be doing. Like the last one I just sent was her five-year-old daughter can ride a bike without training wheels, and how they start that as this balance bike thing at 2 and 3 years old. So I said this to all of my friends, and they're like, I'm going to get my child a balance bike, and I'm going to get my best friend's daughter a balance bike for the holidays this year. So, but good, good content. She was great. So it's great to be back on screen and have a conversation with you. How are you?
I'm good. Just busy actually with work. So it's nice to talk about work. Yeah. Dramatic segue. Talking about work after work. But this is a topic that's close to both of our hearts, yeah. Right? Because we've both worked in corporate, we've both worked in lots of different organizations, and mm-hmm. And once you get in your late 30s and you're a woman in the workplace, you've seen some things. So actually I want to tell a story to kick us off.
Yes, please.
When I was fresh out of college, I was working for a big IT consulting company. I was like as a project manager or whatever. And I walked in my first day under my new boss, basically. And she and I were like some of the only women on the team, because it's an IT company. You know, there's a lot of male dominated. And I think she wanted to like be my mentor. Like she was so excited to tell me, advice and all this. And I was like, okay, great. Because I'm fresh out of college. I don't know anything. I'm just like I'm a silly little, kid, basically bright-eyed, bushy-tailed. So we're talking and she's telling me what my assignment is going to be. And as I'm leaving her office, she says, can I give you one piece of advice? Mm-hmm. I said, sure. She said, don't bake cookies and bring them to the office. And I was like,
okay,
first of all, what about my face makes it look like I bake? Cause I don't. But second of all, that's really weird advice. Like what in the world? But as I've gotten older and I've seen more things, I've started to see that women have to watch the way we comport ourselves in the workplace, so that unfortunately we don't get stereotyped or pegged in certain dimensions as like the person who brings cookies, AKA the domestic one, AKA the one who's always willing to clean up the messes and work in the background and take care of everybody in more like maternal role, instead of being the one who leads and is in charge and is decision-making. And this is a really dumb, false dichotomy. You can be a badass boss bitch and still make cookies for people, right? That's right. Those are not mutually exclusive things, but we've been socialized to have these very gendered roles in the workplace. There are jobs considered male jobs and considered female jobs. Finance is considered a male job. HR is considered a female job. And we have gendered these things completely unnecessarily to the detriment of all of us, because what happens is people, based on their gender expression, get siloed into these different parts of the company, not necessarily based on what they're actually good at, but based on how they've been socialized to believe that this is where they belong. And that's a huge problem for organizations, because that means wrong people might get into the wrong spot, and you're not promoting the right people to leadership or training them for leadership, because they don't have, quote, traditional leadership qualities that we associate with masculinity. Oh, so I'm on a soapbox already. I am fired up to talk about this. But listen, so I don't know if you're listening, have you ever brought cookies to the workplace? And if so, how did that go for you? Do you think it impacted people's opinion of you? Because that's just, to me, it's just, I just want to do something nice for people and I want to make them cookies. And that shouldn't impact how I'm seen at work.
You gave me a dip, like, and I'm just thinking about this now, I've not even said this to you before, but one of the things I'm thinking about is an experience that I had that like racializes that gendered experience. So can I share that story with you? So and we can talk about probably why this is. I had a boss at one of my jobs. They'll remain nameless because I still don't like them. So I won't name them or the institution that they were at. But
probably
some of those folks who worked with me will know exactly who they are. But I worked at a job and my boss was a woman, a white woman. And she was not nice. She was very mean, very nasty, very condescending, all of those things. And she was coming to tell us, she would not come to our staff meetings. She was the head of this group, this team, but she would only send our associate. So let's say she's the director. She would only send her four associate directors to the meetings, and she would never come because she did not ever want feedback on what was happening on all of the things. And the one time she came to the meeting, she literally brought cookies. So it was like not cookies as a, here's something nice for you. It was cookies as manipulation, not to tell her all the feedback she had.
Oh man.
And she came because at that particular meeting, they were giving us raises, but not because they wanted to. This is big in the FMLA thing that was happening with a lot of wage fighting and how we were going to do this in overtime. So they were
placating cookies. They were right. Consolation cookies.
And then she told us we should be grateful that we're all getting raises. But she didn't give us a raise. I was working in the state of New York, which farther puts all the people who know me where that was. But I was working in New York, and New York decided that anybody who had FMLA, the federal overtime laws, had to get a raise. And she was like, I'm giving you a raise. And I was like, are you giving us a
Uncle Sam's giving us a raise.
So and then they also charged us more money on the back. They started charging us rent and food money because I lived at this workplace. So it was a really interesting thing. So when you said the cookies thing, it triggered a negative experience in me, and that somebody did it for placating. But that also, when we and we'll talk about this, and I would love to start with defining some of these terms so our audience and folks who are listening can also understand what they are and get a little bit of background around them. But it drew, and I know we'll talk about this, it drew something in about how there's gender and then there's gender plus race, which is also a dynamic. And then when you add in other things like disability, when you add in things like socioeconomic status, that makes it even more disenfranchised for folks. So I'm sure that there are many stories out there. Sexual orientation.
So we want to take an intersectional approach to this. We don't want to just talk about gender. We can't, because there's too many factors here that matter in this conversation.
Absolutely. So first, I'd love to talk about the glass ceiling. So Mel, what's your knowledge of what the glass ceiling is? And I'll share a little bit about what I've learned about it.
Why don't you jump in? Because I know that you, I think you just were like looking up when the term was coined, right? When was it?
So 1978 by a woman named Marilyn Loden in a speech that she was doing about gender and equality in the workplace. So I think that's one that I think more people understand and know is the glass ceiling is kind of termed as how far women can get before they hit the ceiling of where they can't get to. And for white women or women, and in 1978, it was termed for all women. But now, as you know, Mel and I talked about with the different cookie stories, we and having intersectionality, we look at the different ways it affects different groups of women. But the glass ceiling is also that it's something you can see, but you may not be able to penetrate it. So you're living under this glass ceiling.
Nice use of the word penetrate there, ew, but also it's appropriate.
Like it is.
I hate that word so much, but in this particular case, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's and I hope it's yeah. not a, this is another word people hate, a moist ceiling.
God, stop it. Get out of here.
Yeah, so that's the glass ceiling.
Yeah, a glass ceiling. So yeah, so it's a, you can see the levels above you. Another, a word image that I've seen used too is a ladder with broken rungs, right? Mm-hmm. Like you can, all these other people have ladders that work and they can get up there, you know, like especially white men. But for women and especially women of color, those ladders are either shorter than other people's ladders or the rungs are broken. So it just, it takes so much more effort to get to climb.
Absolutely. So that kind of leads me into the next term that was coined is this term, not concrete, but bamboo ceiling. So the bamboo, and I'll talk about concrete in a second, but the bamboo ceiling was coined in 2005 by Jen Huen, who wrote a book about how Asian American people can, it's called Breaking the Bamboo Ceiling, Career Strategies for Asians, where she talks about breaking barriers and how to do so. So then the bamboo ceiling is sort of like the glass ceiling in that it's, maybe it's a little bit, maybe it's not as penetrable and maybe you can't see it, but there are ways and strategies that you can employ. And she did it in a really great way that you can employ to get you there. And that was coined in 2005.
How does the model minority thing play into that, do you think? Like,
so there's going to be different ways, and I don't want to take it out of context because I am not an Asian person, but when we can think about when we think about our countries as so we'll have to talk a little bit about colorism is that all countries have people that are lighter and darker, right? Or most countries. So even in Asian communities, when we're talking about Asian, people are mostly looking at East Asian and are also looking at often Korean, Japanese, and Chinese people. That does not include folks who are Laos, folks who are Vietnamese, who tend to actually not be as socioeconomically successful. And we're also looking at like the coast. So we'll be like, oh, well, Asian people can do this. And I don't know if I've talked about this before, but the model minority myth was coined in 1966 by one New York Times article that was actually created to say that if Jewish people and Asian people can make it, why can't Black people? So it's a really, and I, the first time I was actually doing research on this a few years ago. And when I found the article and it was like, what? So it was made to put people against each other. But when we take into account the model minority myth, it makes it sometimes easier for white people to see themselves in Asian people. Oh, they're studious. Oh, they look more like us because their hair is straight and their skin is lighter.
Capitalistic ethic. Yeah. Exactly. And actually, you can see this statistically in a lot of sectors. Men obviously do better than women, but Asian men sometimes outpace white men in promotions because there's a perception of studiousness and responsibility and all these things. Right. But that puts a lot of pressure on, you know, people who are part of that demographic to live up to this impossible standard that's not human, right? So that's why the model minority myth is so hurtful.
And there are also other aspects of it. When you are not, maybe math isn't your thing, maybe art is your thing. Do you see, are we promoting Asian people doing art in American culture? And I'm not saying in Asian culture, but in American culture, the same way we promote them as studious and help at great at chemistry or what have you. I heard somebody say like, oh, I'll take an Asian doctor, but I don't want, and you know, I don't want Asian, you know, rap music or whatever the case may be. Is and when we think about it too, if you look in cities, very often, even within the coast, because the coast is where Asian people are tending to do the best, because those are the cities that cost the most. And I want to talk about one other thing when it comes to model minorities, is that I heard someone say, and I don't want to misquote or take it and say that this is my own language, but they say that as an Asian person, you can either be a doctor or a cab driver. There's nowhere in between. So what does it look like for Asian teachers, Asian athletes, Asian, all of these other groups of people? And then that also are we taking into account Southeast Asians and not just East Asians? How are we having the conversation? The last thing I wanted to say there is that when we talk about the model minority myth and how smart groups of people like that are, we also have to talk about then, and we won't go too deep into this part of the conversation, but immigration and the Chinese Exclusion Acts and things like that, mm-hmm. that only were allowing people with high level degrees to come over here. So if you're excluding groups of people and saying that they can't come into America unless they have this degree, unless they have a PhD or a, you know, a doctorate or a,
you're selecting for education and talent. Right. And like, of course, then it's not fair to compare those groups of people that you selected certain individuals for and then compare them to everybody else. That's not fair at all.
Right. Yeah. So then we're also, so when we're thinking about the model minority myth, we have to think about all of these holistic things and not this plain, you know, language of that. Yeah. So then the last one of the, not the last one, because we have a couple other terms to define, but I really want to talk about too, the concrete ceiling, which was a term coined in 2016 by, I believe her name is, let me get it right, because I wrote it down, Jasmine Babbers. And this term was coined to talk about the hurdles that women of color face in success in their careers. And the concrete ceiling, the difference between concrete and glass is that women of color often and especially Latinx women, Indigenous women, and Black women cannot even see where it's glass, I can see, but maybe I can't penetrate. When it's concrete, I can't see and it feels impenetrable completely. So I'm stuck here or I'm trying my hardest and maybe I'm chipping away at it, but I'm not able to break it into one giant piece where it comes down and I can be a part of it. So this is where you look at C-suite groups and you may see one person of color, and that one person of color is occupying literally all aspects of diversity. They're a woman, they are disabled, they are Asian, and they're still not, you know, Black women in those positions.
So the concrete ceiling, like, is that because sometimes the top levels of an organization are so like culturally white that they're really difficult to, here's that word again, penetrate if you are a person of color? Like, is that part of it? Why, what makes it a concrete ceiling? Like, why is it hard to see those positions? Is it because there's no representation, or is it because like those spaces aren't even accessible at all to people of color?
Well, thank you for that question, but you've answered part of it in both, right? Like, you can't see it. You might not even be in the room, right? So if there's no person in the room that looks like you, then it's harder to get in the room, because then we get into things like the different types of bias that show up in the workplace. And one of those biases that often show up is affinity bias. I have bias towards people who look and sound like me. So that comes across in things like, oh my God, we went to the same college, so I know you're going to be great at this job because we both went to the same college. Even if we didn't study the same things and then did not know you through that process, we are wearing the same, I'm wearing UPenn socks and you're wearing UPenn socks, which means there's a personhood, I don't want to call it a brotherhood, a sisterhood, but often we're not in the room. And when we're not in the room, or we don't, this is why we have, and I know we're jumping all over, but one of the things that we talk about in my work in corporate America is not doing just mentorship, but sponsorship. Because a mentor is somebody who comes to you and works with you, but a sponsor is somebody who's speaking your name in rooms that you may not be in, suggesting you for projects that you may never see without them, because they are in the room, right? This is that pass the mic. And so it feels impenetrable, because how are we getting there? I can't will myself into the room. And if I try to, I'm I'm often there and then gone really quickly. And that's a couple of the ones that other things we want to define and talk about as well.
I have another question about the concrete ceiling, because that the word concrete evokes two things in my mind. It evokes urbanization and ghettoization, and it evokes incarceration. So if we're thinking about this in a larger systemic issue perspective, like I'm thinking of recently, I had a conversation with a young white man who recently graduated from college, but he was the first person in his family to go to college. And he was telling me, even as a white student, how hard it was for him to be a first generation college student, because he just had no understanding of what it took to work and think and succeed at that level. Like, and he was just telling me it was like one of the hardest things he's ever done in his life, just graduating from college, because he had no role models. He had nobody showing him the ropes. And so it makes me think, like, you take a really smart, talented person, but you don't give them any socialization for business decorum, professional culture. Like, if they don't have access to any of that stuff that comes naturally to those of us who, like, grew up watching our parents go to work and dress for work and talk like they're at work, right? It's all those really subtle things that you get when you're just kind of around people who are in business versus if you have never been exposed to that. That to me, so do you think there's an educational, generational component to the concrete ceiling as well?
Maybe not as generational, but I will say, and I'm a first gen student, and I actually, right before we jumped on this, on our live call for the podcast, my niece called me, and she is a rising senior. I don't even know how they call it. I think she's a junior right now, or junior and a half, depending on when she graduates. She's a double major. And one of the things I talked to her about, because I'm first gen and technically she's first gen because we didn't grow up in, we're not in the same household. She's not my child. She's my sister's child, and my sister didn't go to college and I did. So I'm first gen. She's sort of first gen as well. And one of the things I said to her is that when you graduate as a Black student, as a first gen student, you're going to graduate with whatever degree you go to school with, but also a degree in code switching. Yeah. I graduated with, I got my master's and my honors in code switching now. And
can you define that term for those who aren't familiar with it?
So code switching, and this is not particular to Black people, but it happens with Black people a lot. It's where you learn how to speak in certain ways that are acceptable in a Eurocentric context. So words like, I would say some coded languages, things like that you said, Mel, professionalism. What is professionalism? It's very Eurocentrically standard. So if I talk like, yeah, I mean, whatever, blah, 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 blase, blase, we gonna bend a corner and all of that at home. When I go to work, I can't speak that way, like at all. And people will say, well, you're just speaking so professionally. This is also where Black people get the Black-handed compliment that we're so articulate.
Did you call it a Black-handed compliment?
Did I call it?
No, but that's amazing.
Freudian slip.
I think that's amazing. So this is, and I've heard white people be like, code switching's not a thing. That's not the hard. Okay, oh, but absolutely a thing. I want you to go talk to your best friend and then turn around and talk to your grandma. Do you speak the same way around both those people? You code switch, everybody code switches, but you don't have to do it in order to save your livelihood or to save your life or to not go to jail. Like, that's the difference.
And also to get ahead in any workspaces, right? Yeah. So, it's hard because I think code switching is a masterful art and also should not have to be something that you do. Like, no, I'm not going to talk at work the same way I talk at home. This is why when people say bring your full self to work, like, I try to stop using that language at work. I mean, my full self is sitting on the couch in pajamas eating chips in the one that fell on my stomach on the floor. That's my real authentic self, but that's not what business deals are going to happen in that work. So we code switch. And often I actually went to a conference a few years ago and somebody talked about code switching, having I think it also happens for poor white folks, even more so code switching in work. If you have an accent that's Southern. So you have this Southern or the Southern drawl, because when we ask people outside of America what they think about America, they give you two accents. One is this this hillbilly sounding, and I'm using that in a facetious way, sort of. It's this Southern drawl or it's a California Valley girl. It's like, those are the two. Oh my God, I'm getting my latte, or like, I'm sipping my sweet tea on the porch. Like, it's yeah. like Forrest Gump, or I don't know who's a
Kardashian. I'm a California girl and I'm blonde and I had to grow up with blonde California girl jokes. You have no idea. I mean, if I'm fine, right. I've turned out fine. But like, yeah, that's the thing. And so, yeah, we swim in this ocean of stereotypes and, mm-hmm. and we mm-hmm. try not to bring it in the workplace, but it's absolutely there. It's absolutely there. And we assume that some people, if someone walks in with a Southern accent, often assume that they're not less smart. Intelligent. Mm-hmm. Ted Lasso is a really good example of this. Have you seen that show?
I've heard of it, but I have not watched it, but I have heard a lot about his show.
We won't have to talk about it, but that's a good example of someone who has a Southern accent. Everyone assumes they're really stupid, but actually he's really brilliant with people and you just don't see it until you get to know him. Right. But the same cuts with gender, it's and race, right? These things that we have been raised from a very early age to believe that once someone opens their mouth and something comes out, or once you see them, you're going to automatically have a list of assumptions in your head about that person. They are kind of guilty until proven innocent. Right. But other people, like white men who speak confidently and wear a nice shirt, are seen as innocent until proven guilty. So it's, you know, it's not fair.
It's funny for me. I graduated from a local, I guess to us, it's like a local school, Temple. And then I went to UPenn, and I was so, and this is when we cut into things like imposter syndrome. And I've actually tried to wipe that from my language, because I was so afraid. And I think I've said this story before, in that I was so afraid at UPenn. I had so much imposter syndrome that I didn't think I would get in. I didn't think I'd do well. I didn't buy anything because I was like, what if I get kicked out? And I really had to make that situation or that experience fit me, because I was like, always worried that I wasn't going to do well enough just really? By virtue. Right. And this is a school I grew up around. It's in my, where I grew up in Philadelphia. That's where I'm from. But I didn't even apply to as an undergraduate student. I didn't apply to Penn because it wasn't something. But when you going back to what you were saying, like, if you are not prepared for this environment, there was nobody in my family who went to college. So I worked a full-time job and I lived on my own or with a roommate. So it was you also have this, and there's a great, great movie or documentary style movie called The Prep School Negro by Andre Robert Lee, who I follow on all social media platforms, and we're from the same place. He wrote about going to the school called Germantown Friends School in Philadelphia. He was bused. It was these busing programs. He was bused there. But what he said resonated with me in going to college was that you are now different than you are in both worlds, right? I can't, when I go home, my family doesn't understand what it's like to be in college or all of the pressures that exist with the exams and the things and how I'm other than the classroom, because it's not the world that they live in, right? They don't go to college. They haven't gone to college. They don't understand how hard it is. And when I'm in college, they don't understand that I don't come from this world of, oh my God, what are you doing over the summer? Yeah, we're going to Italy. Mine's just like, no, I'm going to work. Like, what do you mean?
What a wild experience. I mean, I know you've told me bits and pieces of this, but I've never heard this whole story. And earlier when you were saying that, like, you struggled with imposter syndrome, I know you as such a confident, like, confident, capable person. It boggles my mind to think of you any other way. So I can't even, it's even hard to picture you, you know, because you're such a boss. Like, you get all these amazing jobs and you're always like giving people great advice about, and I just like, man, I would have liked to meet like Tyshelle, who is like unsure of herself, because I've never met that Tyshelle
and
before.
I also would say you probably wouldn't have seen it on the outside, because mm-hmm. if we were friends, then you'd maybe know that this class is hard and I got to go to work. But if we weren't Black friends, if you weren't a Black person, that's not an experience that I know. Like, a lot of Black people are not saying to white people all of the struggles. This is why when 2020 happened and all the white people were like, I asked my Black friend and they said that everything was fine. I had no idea. It's like, because I don't want to burden you with the problems that you may not understand how to even engage with, right? Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes when somebody says, oh, when somebody dies or something, somebody says, sorry for your loss. that's like, it feels like a platitude at times because they have no idea what you're going through. So yeah. I might not have even explained it well enough because it was an experience that not many people that I knew, even my friends, didn't know what I was going through. All of my friends from high school that didn't go to college with me, they'd be out on a Saturday night and I'd be like, oh man, I wish I'm out. But I'm literally sitting in Van Pelt Library on UPenn's campus for 12 hours on a Saturday because I have to work on Monday. So I don't have time to do my paper on a Monday. I will say, last thing I'll say about my own experience, because it's not just about me, is I bought a keychain my second semester of my first year. And it was the first and only thing I bought that semester besides the books, because I said, if I get kicked out of this school and I don't do well enough, I can throw that keychain away and nobody will know. So when I graduated, I bought the same keychain and I now have both on my keychain, on my keys. So to remind me of where I came from and how I got there, but I'm also not one of those people who's like, I did it all by myself. That's like the muscly way to say I pulled myself up by my boosh. No, there were people who helped me along the way. Sure. There were people who I encountered. So I try to rid myself because what I realized by the time I graduated, Mel, and why maybe but I've always been this person, but very confident in certain ways, especially academically, is that I had to make that situation and that experience fit me and stop trying to fit it. So I was one of those people. I'm terrible at note taking. I want to take a note taking. I'm so bad at note taking. I'll be looking around in class and people will be taking notes and I'd be like, should I be writing this down? And then I'd be like, what'd you get on that test? I actually just came up in my timeline of a girl I went to school with. And it was like, hey, what did you get on this so-and-so test? And she asked me what I got on the test and I got a B+. And she just didn't respond. Like, nope, not going to say what I got on this test. But I wasn't confident as much. So another one I wanted to talk about as we go back into this off of just me and the experience I'm having, because I can definitely tell you more personal experiences of working in corporate America or working even in an industrial complex or education, is the glass cliff. And Mel, could you share a little bit more about the glass cliff as I take some sips of water?
Yes. So glass cliff, and this is like particularly insidious. I don't think it happens all the time on purpose, but probably subconsciously it happens on purpose, you know? So a glass cliff is when a company and organization is not doing well, or they're entering a time of recession, or the company's about to like crash and burn somehow. It's very common for that board or the shareholders to elect a woman or a diversity hire to lead the company. Finally, like some of these organizations, like they've never had a woman CEO or president ever, and then suddenly they make a diversity hire. It's very common right after they make that diversity hire for the company to tank, and then they blame it on the person they just hired. So a glass cliff is like literally kind of sacrificing this person to the failure of the company that was probably like two people ago who led the company making the decisions that got them there now. So the reason this happens is because they're trying to like make themselves look good. Like, look, we finally, you know, they're trying to, a lot of times trying to distract from the fact that the company's not doing well. So they make this diversity hire, right? Just so happens to be in the nick of time.
Yeah.
Glasscliff is like, that's really terrible. That's really
the
terrible.
Other thing I want to bring into the glasscliff is, even if a company is doing well, there's a certain, you know, a lot of people went through layoffs in 2021 after the 2020 and layoffs still coming. Apparently they call it the September surge, where people are getting hired, and then the January purge, which then a lot of layoffs happen around those times.
Yeah.
What we see is what they call, I didn't learn this until I got to corporate, is called a RIF, a reduction in force. So if a company needs to restructure or they need to cut, trim the fat, as I think they call it as well. Often yes. the folks to go off the C-suite are also then women as well.
Yeah.
So
usually
women,
the first to get cut. Yeah.
Right. So even if they're not tanking as a company and they're just, we're restructuring, we're doing this, the first people to go off that C-suite level are women. I have literally mm-hmm. seen it happen at companies I worked at where there were, I think, three C-suite women and two of them got let go.
Women
and I
was like, it's more expendable. And you know why? I mean, there's a lot of reasons why, like patriarchy in general, but like we still have this 1950s conception that men are more important breadwinners for the home, and it's more serious to lay off a man than to a woman. Mm. you know, like that's a more serious offense. Like, you know, well, he's the breadwinner. We can't let him go. But like, she, you know, she's got a husband, so she'll be fine. Like,
that reminds me of a story Oprah said. She was 22 or 23 working at a news desk, and she found out how much her male, because she's an anchor. She found out how much her male co-anchor made, and it was like almost double what she was making. And when she went to go ask her boss why, they were like, well, he's a husband. He has a family. You're a single woman. Why do you need that much? She's like, because we're doing the same job.
So. Oprah, bless her. She's a saint among women. Well, not recently. She got in trouble for the Maui thing. Anyway.
Also billionaires. So
yeah, also billionaires. Yeah. Okay.
So then there's
one more term.
I keep saying the last one, but we have a few more. The other I really wanted to bring up that brings into this aspect of intersectionality, and especially for women of color, is what they call the sticky floor. I couldn't find the origin of it specifically, but I've seen it in a lot of articles for women of color. And what the sticky floor is, it is women. Right now we know, and in the past, I would say probably 5 to 7 years, the most educated group are Black women. They are graduating at higher rates. They are the most educated group coming out of, I would say, at least undergrad with bachelor's degree, some even master's. Listen, I got a lot of Black friends and they all want to get PhDs. And I'm like, girl, why? But they, you know, they're doing it. So we are doing it. They're turning them out. And I think it's amazing. But then they experience what they call the sticky floor, in that the higher up in a company you go, the more white, the more male. The lower down in a company you go, the more female, the more brown. And there are women who are working in call centers, working in hourly wage jobs. So I can never remember which one is exempt and non-exempt, but they're working hourly jobs. They are working under bosses who have less degrees than they do. They are getting stuck in these positions. I actually personally mentored a woman who has her bachelor's degree and master's degree, but had been working in sort of a on the phones type of job for 5 years. And her boss and her boss above her did not hold those same degrees as her. And often what happens is they'll be like, oh, well, she's so good at this job, she's not expendable, we can't move her up.
Yeah.
So they get stuck in these places 4, 5, 10 years because of the loyalty of having a good job. And I think this is where generationally it comes in, and we're seeing that change with Gen Z, in that if you're not promoted in 3 years, you're out of here. That was even when we started off in our first working jobs, it was never, I'm going to quit a job after 3 years to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
But that was the pension mentality, and we sure don't have those anymore.
We don't have those anymore. We don't.
So yeah. The sticky floor also is really interesting, because I have also, and I was working at a company where we had a Black woman's affinity space, and there were women who never found out about jobs that were being posted internally before they went external. And by the time they were external, that was where the energy was going to hire women. There was a woman who was a nurse, and she had a higher degree. And she had a bachelor's, her boss had a bachelor's, and not to say that her boss didn't have experience, but she got her master's, and her job didn't even celebrate her getting her master's degree at all, but they celebrated her boss finishing her bachelor's. And sometimes, and this is what leads folks to leaving companies to go find things outside.
Yeah. So there's one more term here that we want to define. It's invisible walls. It's been called different things, but invisible walls, or it's been called, you know, silosation. It's the idea that women get siloed or promoted into more, quote, feminine branches or divisions. Because working with people, working with marketing, working with communications, HR, instead of the, quote, hard skills of business decision-making, financial decision-making, top-level leadership. So technical. These invisible, technical. Yeah, because of these stereotypes that condition us from a really early age to think, oh, well, women are less logical than men, the stereotype goes. So we're not going to encourage women to go to computer programming school. We're going to put them in, we're going to put them in a debutante ball. I don't know. What do we do instead? We let's go to the mall. Like, let's socialize girls to like do girl things that are more communicative. So this starts from a really early age. It doesn't just start when people get into the workforce, right? It starts way early in education. So right now there's a huge push to try to get girls, for example, into coding, into more technical fields, because in some of these industries, women are like less than 20% represented, which is just wild. You know, it's what, like, there is no fundamental difference between a male and a female brain. Like, if you take a brain out of a, you know, a body after life, after death, and you study it, like, most researchers really can't figure out the gender of the brain based on just looking at the brain alone. And this was up until like the 60s or the 70s, most scientists, like the medical community, thought that there was a fundamental difference between male and female brains, that, like, you know, men have like bigger logical capacities. And no, like, neuroscience has completely debunked all of that. Like, we have the same brain. Hormones are a little bit different, but like, brains are.
But it's like, it also has to, when we talk about brain versus hormone, those things have to be switched on at the time in your body when certain things happen, these hormonal changes. And they usually, this is why we don't actually see girls and boys. We see girls and boys, and I'm only talking in binaries right now, but we see, and I'm thinking about as I worked in preschool, we see girls and boys play together until the rate around the age of 6. And most of the reason that it separates is social learning, that boys are this and girls are that, because puberty doesn't usually kick in till about 11 to 13, 14 for people. So that's when you're seeing the changes happen, the hormonal changes. But we start to learn that boys have cooties and girls are gross, whatever, I don't know, at 6 and 7, when they start to notice who they are. This is why when we have conversations about gender, we should be talking as early as 5 and 6 often, because that's when they start to notice who they are in their bodies and who other people are. But that's where we see
patriarchy starts getting hard coded into the way we think, all of it. So before I want to get into talking specifically about patriarchy, and I know this is like going to be maybe basic for some listeners, but for other listeners who've never really thought critically about this, you know, I think we want to get into some of these terms and these ideas, because it's really important to understand how this stuff makes us tick. Before we get there, though, I want to talk about the idea of a power gap. Everything we've discussed so far creates power gaps in the workforce and in our society, because if you take white men and you keep them in positions of leadership and specific decision-making power, and Black women, for example, are stuck on the sticky floor, that means societally, not only do white men have a lot more money, but have a lot more power and decision-making power and say over the way society and markets work. So closing those power gaps is really important. And to give you an example of how bad these power gaps are, there's a wonderful organization called Women's Power Gap. I've actually worked with them as a contractor for several years. I absolutely love them and doing awesome work. They publish these big reports around corporate and academic America, and just look at, like, they actually gather data on the top organizations in the country, and specifically in Massachusetts. And they just say, okay, like, what are we looking at here? Are women like 40%? Men are 60? Like, what are the actual data and how does it break down? So they took Massachusetts and they took the top 75 corporations in Massachusetts, biggest corporations in the state. And they said, okay, what are we expecting to find for women CEOs out of 75 organizations? Do you have a spitball guess, Tyshelle? What do you think? Out of 75, how many women out of 75 organizations are CEOs?
You're asking somebody who, my educated guess would honestly probably be like 3, but I'm
6. You were so close. 6 out of 75. That's just atrocious. It's absolutely atrocious, and no Latinx women representation whatsoever. So it's like, and that's one of the most liberal states in the country. If we can't even get it right or have close to parity in one of the most liberal states in the country, this is abysmal. Like, it's
really, what does it look like in Texas?
Oh my God, I don't even know. But anyway, I encourage you to check out womenspowergap.com. They're a nonprofit. Like, they're not paying us to promote them, but they do really great work. And I think it's really important to look at this stuff. So what's a power gap? How do we close those power gaps? What does that look like to close those power gaps? Not just have like these token diversity hires, but actually like changing this. Their motto is change the system, not the women. Change, right. It's not the women's problem. Women don't need more mentorship. Change the system of how we promote and think about women and people of color as well. And also, like, when you're thinking about these positions of leadership, don't just look at the visible CEOs, also look at who's leading the board, who's making the behind the scenes right. decision. And when you're looking at C-suite, which is like the CEO, CFO, the C-level, you know, and you say, oh, we have so much diversity in our C-suite, but are your diversity people, your head of HR, your head of marketing, and your head of DEI diversity? Like, are all those the women in diversity hires? Or are you actually trying to put people in power who are making decisions, you know, who are actually diverse?
So one of the things I wanted to say that, and I'm glad you kind of went back there to this, you called it invisible walls. I'd like to call it like homemaker in the workplace. That's not just for, and I'm saying this because it's not just for corporate. It also happens in your schools. It's also happening in your restaurants. So I say this because I worked in education for a long time. There are more female teachers, but more male principals. How yep. is that even possible?
Like right, by a long
time. Right. And when we even yeah. look at that, let's break it down further. Well, there are female principals. Okay. But are they usually tend to be principals of elementary schools. Let's yep. take care of the kids where they're not really doing any critical work. Well, even though 0 to 6 is the most critical time. People don't think about that, but it is. It also happens in restaurants. There are more women who cook, but there are more male head chefs. So this is not siloed to like, well, oh, I don't work in, you know, there are more female nurses, but more male doctors, right? And that's not, I mean, that changes a little bit, but when we're thinking about these things, we have to think of how does it look in the groups that we're a part of and the part of society that we inhabit right now. The other thing I wanted to talk about as we talked about power gap that you were saying when it comes to like women of color in the workplace is really looking at, so I was looking at a graphic the other day. It's called, it's about women, Black women in the workplace and how they go from what we call pet to threat. Whoa. And you can probably find the graphic and it talks about getting hired as a Black woman. You are everybody's favorite. They love everything you're doing. They hired you because you're so great. And then in just a few short months or years, and I've experienced this myself, you become a threat because now you want to actually make changes. You want to engage with how these things are going. You want to, so you go from pet, everybody's like, oh my God, Tyshelle's so special. She is so, and I get it all the time.
Oh man.
So captivating. And I'm not saying like, it feels great. But then I go to threat where people are like, I have literally, I hope this person would listen to this podcast. Before I started one of my former jobs, this person, it was a man who reached out to me and he looked me up. Cause you know, when you work in corporate, they like announce that you're coming on. I don't know why they announced that I was coming on. I was a part of an 18 person team, or at the time probably like 10 person team. And they were like, Tashelle's coming or whatever. So they get my bio. And this person looked me up and sent me a direct message on Facebook. Whoa. And I'm not even friends with this person. And
that's not very professional.
No. And I mean, at LinkedIn, fine.
Yeah, but Facebook, weird.
It also tells you how old this person is.
Okay.
This person reached out and said, oh, I heard that you're coming to the company. I'm really excited to see you. I love your pedigree. And I immediately felt like a dog. Yes. I immediately felt
Who
like
does
a dog
that?
Because they looked at my bio. They probably looked me up and if you Google my name, it's not very hard.
They said pedigree. It's unacceptable. It's unacceptable.
No, they said they were talking about my educational pedigree,
but
they, but
that's
what
weird.
They said.
It's weird to say that to a stranger and a person of color.
And like, I just said, thanks. Right. And they didn't also in the announcement, they put my personal email, which is not hard. Or whatever. So that person could have emailed me, but no, they clearly were looking through my profile on Facebook. And most of my stuff is private on Facebook just because like, whatever. And then, so when this pet to threat, they were so excited that I was coming. I was going to be representation. I was so smart. I had a great pedigree and pedigree. Literally, this person did not graduate college. And this is not me downing college because college is an elitist institution. But why are you excited about my educational pedigree going to undergrad and getting a master's at an Ivy League school when you didn't even finish college? That is really strange to me.
It's a weird thing that, like, would they have sought out a white person on Facebook and said those things to them?
Would they?
Do they do that to all the new people who are coming in or just
you? No. And I think they were excited about me because I was a Black woman doing this.
Sure.
Right. And then I will say, after getting to know that person and working with that person a little bit more hands-on, I was leading a workshop that I created, and they said something that that was a little bit not okay. So I gently, I've been facilitating for years. So I was like, hey, I'm not sure if you, what you said, you know, let me help you adjust your language or something like that. And they said, okay, great. And then they reached out to me afterwards and said, I'd like to have a conversation. I had no idea what this conversation was about. They were like, you were being so condescending by telling me that what they said was they used the term flamboyant, and they were like, this is flamboyant. I said, you can't actually, there are times where you can't. They were talking about a gay person in this.
It's
terrible. It just gets worse and worse.
Oh, it's so cringeworthy.
But what they were saying was, they were saying I wasn't calling that person flamboyant. I was saying that the behavior was flamboyant in the definition of flamboyant. So what I explained to them in this one-on-one conversation that they sought out is that there are terms and times that you cannot separate a word from how it has been bastardized. You cannot use a swastika and say it's a Japanese symbol of peace anymore. You can't. And so an example I used, which I thought was very funny, was like, if I say I'm going to hoe in the backyard, you know that I'm using hoe as a garden tool. But if I say I'm gonna go hoe down the street, I might be going for good times. So that is very different. I was trying to show them. I was trying to show them that context matters,
sure.
And that you can't say flamboyant and gay person in the same sentence and not have people feel a type of way about it.
Right.
So they were like, I don't think you get what I'm saying, because they were talking about Black people and white people. And I was like, you're still wrong. Oh, they also, then they went on to give another example. And they were like,
a lot more patient than I would be, but also like, you kind of have to be, right? Like
I was educating. Let me finish too. So they were like, they were saying also like, Black people can't come in and just be really loud and brash all the time. We have to. And I said, do we ever tell white people they have to be a little less country and a little less rock and roll?
What?
Do we ever do that?
Oh my gosh.
So by the end of that conversation, this person said, you're condescending me. It's like, you're the teacher and I'm the student. And I was like, you came to my workshop.
You were the teacher
I created. And I'm literally facilitating it. But in that situation, I went from pet, I can't wait to see you here with your most amazing educational pedigree, to threat, in that I don't want you to talk to me like that because you're not the teacher and I'm the student. And I had to try to have a conversation, and I still...
So it's hard. A lot of white people, like, oh, we're gonna
Let's also say men and white people. So we're not always white people, because this person was a Black man.
Okay. So we're gonna celebrate diversity, hip hip hooray, until it actually requires something from us. It requires change, it requires critical thought, it requires growth or evolution. And then we are gonna kick the diversity out of the club. Not allowed anymore. You can only stay if you are placating the patriarchy. You can only stay if you're placating the capitalism, right? If you can only stay if you don't rock the boat.
If you don't require anything of me.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And then, oh, whoop-de-doo. I love having you here. Great. But that is not an equal relationship. That is not a relationship of peers. That is turning someone into decorative furniture for your pleasure and comfort.
I think that somebody, that's what you said made me think of how somebody said in La La Land, what's his name? John Legend was Black wallpaper in this thought of decorative furniture. Like, he wasn't in the movie. He was just in the movie.
Yeah.
As these white people save jazz. That's what a student said to me.
Yeah. So let's get into this. So I know we're getting short on time, but I think it does bear saying, like, patriarchy will always claim to love women.
Mm-hmm.
Performativity. So like, when we're celebrating diversity, hip hip hooray, will always claim to have the best interest of people of color in mind. Neither of those things do ultimately. At the core, there is an inequality. There is a dishonoring and even in many cases, like, ultimately a hatred and a disrespect for underrepresented groups at the core of it. They will claim all day long not to be that way, but at the core of it, it is. At the core of it, you're saying women are less capable, people of color are less capable of being trusted with making decisions, with teaching, with leading, with speaking with credibility, right? At the core of it, it is a hatred that you cannot ignore. Like, it's there. It's there if you look hard enough. It is there. And so it is within, and even those of us who are part of underrepresented groups, in the many diverse ways we are, we internalize it too. Like, how many times have I said, oh, I can't do that, I'm just not good at that, without actually saying, oh, well, if I took the time to learn it, then I could become good at it because I have a brain that's capable of doing that, right? Like, so, I put it in my own self, in my
exactly.
own
body. And so one of the things that I know you and I had been talking about, but also I think leads into what this is too, is this is why you will hear people say, I love women. I have a wife, a mother, a daughter, but then they'll be still saying heinous things because the thought of that is that I own, or those things are close to me and I don't have to, but what, and those are things I want, I care about, and I get to protect because they're under me.
They're
and
mine. Think,
right. And I property. Own, and that doesn't threaten my position. My wife doesn't threaten my position. My sister, my mother, or my daughter doesn't threaten any position that I have. But this is why we also talk about when there's not a misogynist who would say, most misogynists don't say they hate women. Like that doesn't happen as much, but you have to love women who are not familially connected to you or in some way, you're attracted to.
Right.
What about the woman? What about the ugly woman? And I say ugly because beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So that's anybody. Like, how do I love the fat woman, the dark woman, the disabled woman, in the same way that I care about the people that I know and love as well? And I say the same thing. What about the Black person you really don't like? Do you also stand up for their rights as well? And this is the difference, as we were talking about going back a little bit, misogyny versus patriarchy, because patriarchy is a big tree and misogyny is a part of that and how it shows up. And it also, as the Black community talks about it, it shows up in Black men in the form of misogynoir, in that they want to protect and care for Black women, but don't want them to be anything different than a wife, a mother, or a daughter. So when we're having those conversations, it becomes a different way to engage and how we need to have them. There's been a lot going on in the media about with men and violence and all of these things. And it's like, I heard a father say, and it really, really warmed my heart. He said, he's picking up his son from school, probably four or five. And he said he liked this little girl at school. And most dads will say, is she cute? Is she pretty? What kind of dress was she wearing, or what have you, as if all little girls go to school in dresses and not shorts and t-shirts either. He said, what do women need most? And I was so ready to cringe. And his son's response, which is what he taught him, was women need space. And
yes.
I have never heard anybody say that. What do women need most? And he said, space. Yeah. And little boy responded, space. So even if you like her, she still needs space.
Space, right? To be, and space to exist, not in relationship to a man. And this is why those of us who are raised in patriarchy, who identify as women, we have to do so much unlearning, because we were raised to believe that we only exist when we are in relation to two men, when we are mothers of men and partners of men and sisters of men. We don't get space to exist on our own right, and we start seeing ourselves as subpar because we are always orbiting like a little moon around the men in our life, and we never get to be the planet. And so it takes a lot of learning.
I'm a planet, damn it.
Planet. I'm a planet. I'm not even Pluto. I'm freaking Mars. I'm going to be in the middle and I'm going to be fire.
I got rings and shit. Like, no. The other thing I was thinking about too is this notion of women as gatekeepers. And this happens in the workplace very often. If you look at most companies, most of their communications people are also white women.
Yep.
And the communications folks in most companies, so this is not specific to any company, But if you look at communications, they're usually the barrier between a lot of the company and the CEO or the C-suite group.
Yep.
And what often can happen is that we say, hey, we'd like to have our pronouns in our signature. And communications will say, oh, we can't do that. Communications and legal, but usually communications will say, oh, we can't do that. Oh, we asked the CEO, we asked the C-suite team, and that's just not on our radar right now. So then you can't even go and have a conversation with anybody else because it got stopped right at communications. And I use that to illustrate gatekeeping. So gatekeeping is what women do, or any group, any marginalized group does to each other. So the reason it's called gatekeeping is and there's two ways of gatekeeping as well, because there's a positive version of gatekeeping as well, too. But gatekeeping will say, before the dad, before the CEO comes home, or the metaphorical work home, I'm going to tell you how to get in line so that we look good as a unit.
And we don't get kicked out of the club.
Right. So if I was to gatekeep, and this happens with women of color, it happens with women, is that I'm telling you how to, I'm going to give an example from me as a Black woman. I am a Black woman. I am a C-suite member, or I'm close to C-suite AVP. Oh, that's actually TV show.
What?
I'm gonna give an example from a TV show I watched. So there's a TV show called Insecure, and on Insecure, the character of Molly is a lawyer, and she's working at a firm where there's not that many Black people. So she's one of the lawyers at this firm, and another Black woman gets hired as a paralegal or a legal secretary, something like that. But this girl who comes in, her name is Keisha. So this is already denoting how different she's going to be, or how, what they would say, she's ghetto. But Keisha's got long hair, long nails, she pops her gum, she doesn't code switch, and Molly cannot physically stand this girl. She's like trying to tell her, you can't act like this. Like, because if you act like this, you're going to cut it off for all of us. We can't show up that way. So she was trying to gatekeep. She was trying to be the gatekeepers to the CEO and say, act different. So that's also respectability politics comes in there as well. Like, I need you to dress this way, sound this way, act this way, because this is the way that's acceptable to show up. So they become the gatekeepers of others by using respectability politics to keep others in line. And what really happens there is that you're not letting people be their full potential. And then if I am being told that respectability politics is the way we have to act in this way, and this can show up for people of color very often, but in other cases as well, is that I don't get to live and be my full potential. This is the woman who told you not to bring cookies. She was trying to give you good advice, but what she was doing was also respectability politics.
Yeah.
In that you can't be your full self. What if you really love to bake cookies and you're really good at it, and that's something you'd want to share, but now you have this mentality, I can't do that because of this. So what that does is that you can't be your full human self in the way that you would want to show up, because it's not acceptable in this place. And somebody told you that it wasn't. Now, sometimes
I have such mixed feelings about it. Because also as a young blonde, recent college grad in the workplace, I'm highly likely to be infantilized, treated like a child, right? I kind of practically still was a child. I was a little, you know, 22-year-old, whatever. But I think there is something to be said for demanding that the people around you not treat you like a child. But some people, and I would say men as well, I've known people who have done vocal coaching for the way they speak so that they can lower the register of their voice, because it's perceived as more professional to sound more masculine.
Incompetent. White women go up and people go down.
Yeah. And having a high Disney princess voice usually doesn't get you very far, right? We've all seen Legally Blonde. So I think, again, if we're talking about change the system, not the women, change the system, not the people of color, is there more space that we can occupy and bring ourselves to our workplace without having to change who we are in order to, is it possible to change the workplace? And this is a larger conversation that we are having as a society. Like, is it possible to change the workplace? Does the workplace, do we benefit in the workplace and in these organizations if we allow for more diversity and get comfortable with the uncomfortability of that? And I think, yeah, because when you're talking about generating creativity and ideas, if people can be more themselves and be more free to express and even tap into, God forbid, their inner child, they're going to probably come up with better and more creative ideas. And that actually is better for the company. So, I mean, yeah, this is a whole kind of like edge of work that we're doing as a society. But then there's other people who now have decided, like the Supreme Court, that affirmative action and diversity is somehow detriment to society. So like we have this, we really do have like a culture war happening right beneath our noses on some people on one extreme. Diversity really is like the future and what's going to save us from a lot of the problems that we've inherited from our past generations. And on the complete other side of the spectrum, diversity is bad. If you think diversity is good, then you need to get the heck out of here. We're going to criminalize diversity. And, you know, so like this, it's really wild stuff.
It gives me some imagery too. One thing I wanted to say, that you talk, as you talk about like, people in the workplace, and if it doesn't change the system and not the people or the women, one of the things I always tell people, and I try not to use the language of pipeline, because I think pipeline denotes a little bit of connotation or some sort of negative connotation for Indigenous folks, but they call it in most corporations, they call it a talent pipeline. Mm-hmm. I always tell people, and for lack of a better term, I'm using that just so for more familiarity, I'm using that.
I think, but I would say pool. Fine. Yeah, I would say.
Yes, I've heard people say different things. So I'm saying, yeah. So now I try to use talent pool versus pipeline. But for familiarity, I'll say pipeline is that if people of color, if women, if Indigenous folks are not getting through the pipeline, something is not wrong with those people and groups, and we don't need to mentor them out of it. We need to change the pipeline, because that's where the problem is.
It's the pipes, not the water inside of it. Like, exactly. It's not the people trying to come through. There's some blockages in that system.
So the other imagery that came in my head as you talked about our world changing in 2050, more people will be biracial or triracial or multiracial in some capacity than one mono race. So I don't want to just say white race, but a mono race. So you won't be mono racial, right? Like I did my ancestry DNA and I think I'm like 93% Black and I'm like 6% white, and we know why that is. But so there'll be more people who are multiracial than white. Is that the image that popped in my head is this image of trying to hold back water in a dam. Mm. And then the other thing that popped in my head is, I believe in Texas, they were throwing buoys into the water as migrants were coming. And they were actually really harming them. And why that popped in my
head. Wait, sorry, can you say that again? I'm not quite sure what you mean.
So governor, they were putting in Texas buoys into the water that were harming migrants as they tried to come through the waters between Texas.
They were?
Yeah.
Oh gosh. Okay,
it was not just stopping them, it was harming them and hurtful and things like that. It's the same thing that happens on if people are coming through borders, or coming to cross the border on land, they sometimes die from starvation, sun, all of those things. And to me, why that popped in my head is because we are trying to stop the diversification of our society that is happening. It just is happening. There are people who are more multiracial and multicultural by putting in these big, broad, barbed wire, by saying like, oh, you have to stop diversity hiring because that's racist against the majority dominant groups. But like, if we're really digging into that, I'm really hoping some legislation and some law groups are really working on this. This is why intersectionality is a term that started in law, and so did critical race theory with Kimberly Crenshaw and other critical race theorists. That is important to note that if my company is 90% white, and or 70%, mostly more like 60, 70% white, and is predominantly and historically white, how is hiring from a diverse framework going? How are we going to ever have equity or equality if we don't do any of that? So they're saying racial hiring is actually really racist. Okay, but are we talking about how it's been really racist and that's how the company is 90% men, 90% white, 90%, you know, all of those things. And so I think I'm hoping, and I know that, and I don't want to just hope. I also want to make sure I'm doing the studying, learning, listening, doing the work and promoting people. And I'm going to say it, voting to make sure the right people are in places to really get into that, because there's a lot of lawyers and then groups of people who are trying to put in legislation to drive further wedge issues into what you were talking about as a culture war, so that white people don't lose their place as the majority and the dominant group. But that's just, it's not realistic. And it also says, we're not saying that you have to stop being or give up for us to have, this is the hierarchical, the scarcity mindset. And that if we're all sitting around the table, we're going to make sure there's enough for all of us, versus if there's only one turkey, I have to get it and I have to punch you in the face so you can't get to it. That doesn't really work for anyone. It does not work for white people either.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. And also, the spirit of democracy is representation. The fundamental spirit is, like, if you have a population that's 60% white and 40% people of color, every organization, every institution in the country should reflect that identity and representation. And if it doesn't, there's a huge problem. There's a huge problem in the way that we're running things. Like, this is not rocket science. It is not that difficult to figure out that there, you know, we should have representation. It's just basic human fairness.
It makes me think at the beginning of Robin DiAngelo's book, she lays out how corporations are in certain aspects of our corporate life or what have you are still 90% white. So, like, 70 to 90% white. So MLB and CEOs and just all of the different things. And, you know, it's hard because I don't want to replace white dominance with black dominance. That doesn't work. I don't want to replace male dominance with female dominance. And that's where equity comes into play, because people are like, we need to have a woman president because a woman president is going to be better. Not if she's the same as this male president. Like,
no, right.
That's not going
to work. Let's find the most qualified person for the job. And then we will also consider, like, yeah. Okay. What's top of mind for you? I know we got to wrap up soon. We're getting long.
No, I was going to say that. Yeah. So that's what I'm really thinking about as we talk about these different power grabs. And they have done it. And that the last thing I'll say about that is that they have done it in other countries to make a certain group of people, certain percentage has to be diversity. So it can work. There are models for it. We don't have to create it out of thin air.
Great. Yeah.
What's top of mind for me? So I actually just made I don't make TikToks very often. I make them very, very sporadically. I do not ever rehearse them. I know how people rehearse their TikToks. For me is that father talking to his son saying, what do women need space? When we're having conversations about patriarchy and misogyny, we're having from the lens of, like, I care about my family and things like that. And there was something that happened in the media with a woman, and something that happened to her and being assaulted. And there's been lots of online conversation, at least in my news feeds. And the conversation I have been having there and in other places is that, like, I'm married, I have a husband, but we have a lot of equity in our relationship, not necessarily always equality. Like, I'm better at cooking. I also don't want to eat his food, so he does most of the cooking. I do a lot of cleaning in my house because I don't want to say neat freak, but I like it clean. Like, I enjoy clean more than anything in my home. So I do, and I'm also work from home. So I do a lot of cooking and cleaning. And he does a lot of driving, but that's not because he's a man and because I'm a woman. These are just things that we are good at. And every relationship should be able to have whatever it looks like for them. And not the problem, the idea is not to say that you can't have heteronormative, whatever. The idea is to say that everyone in those positions are consenting and enthusiastically consenting to the roles that they have, and that equity lives in that relationship as well. And I can't say that it always does, because there's invisible work that women have to do. But for me, what's top of mind is that. And then also I'm listening to a new new to me. I mean, I stopped saying new. I'm not Columbus. I didn't discover it, but new to me podcast called Third Space. That is talking about DEI in schools, in the K-12, in working with students. And the podcast came to me from some folks that I follow on LinkedIn that were guests on it. I liked it so much. I'm going back to 2018, listening to their first. I've already gotten through two of their episodes just today. And I say that because I'm always doing continuous improvement, continuous education. I promote other people doing this great work because we can all be in this space together. And one of the things that this person said, and I'm just going to read it because it's really top of mind, was that this question that Rosetta Lee, who is a DEI and consultant and the former science teacher who does this work, said that at the end of the podcast, they asked, what are things that you are thinking about, things that you want people to know? And this part, and she said, Rosetta Lee said, she said, I want to ask people to start to investigate, where are your growth zones? How are you chipping away at them, right? Where are the places that you feel nervous and scared? That's where you should be going to chip away at them. And I say that a lot, but I say it in a very different way. So even me hearing it in the way that she said it really resonated with me, because I always tell people that the groups that you are, and this is the way I usually say it, the groups that you are a part of, think about the groups that you inhabit. The actual ones you inhabit. I am a cisgendered Black woman, lower middle. And even that is confusing me for me because I grew up poor and I'm sort of middle class now. What are the groups that I inhabit? Because those, if I think about who's the most vulnerable in the groups that I inhabit, those are the people that I stand to be able to oppress the easiest. So for me, that's Black trans women. I stand to be able to oppress Black trans women just easy, really easily to do it.
I've never heard that before. It makes sense though. Yeah.
And I also stand to be able to oppress people without as much education as I am. And I can do that just in my rhetoric, in my language, in my attitude. I could write off anybody who has less education than me because I got it. You know, you should get it. Or I could devalue their voice when they're in the room because I have a degree or two and they don't have any. Or Black trans women by saying, oh, if I meet a guy and I'm interested in him, oh, you date trans women? Oh, that's not good. Right. So just that language could incite violence toward them. That could also disenfranchise people who don't have money. So those kinds of things. So those are the places that I need to be rooting my work in.
Yeah.
But also chipping away at anything that I feel nervous and scared about. So those are the top of mind for me. What's top of mind for you?
Thank you. Yeah. Top of mind for me is really like the only thing that's in my, that I can think about right now is just how important it is for people who have access to spaces of power to do a couple of things. And I think a few years ago before I really started doing more of this, like, intersectional work, I would have said, oh, just hold the door open. It's so easy. Just hold the door open. That's not enough. It's not enough to just hold the door open. You need to, open the door. But sometimes that door is deadbolted and you have to be the one to go out on a limb and say, hey, you know what? We're going to unbolt the door now and we're going to crack it open and then we're going to open it a little bit more, but we're not just going to stop there. We're going to make sure this space we're opening the door for, we're going to make sure this space is hospitable to people who might walk through that door. We're going to see if we need to make some changes. We need to do some construction in here to make sure this is a welcoming space. And then once you have that done and the door's open, welcome people inside. Say, hey, come in here. We want you here, not just as a token, but as an equal. We value your opinion. We're going to stop the pet to threat thing. And we're actually going to treat you like a whole real human being who has the ability to, you know, be both kind and pleasant and critical and say hard things. So yeah.
Can I add something to that?
Please do.
That specifically for people of color, or more so for people of color, because that opening the door is really important. I encourage women of color, especially, and I've experienced having good leadership of people of color and bad. And I say this because anybody can be a good boss or a bad boss, but do not close the door behind you. There are women who come into the room, especially women of color or people of color who are used to being, they call it the crabs in the barrel, Like, I can't get there, so I'm pulling you back down. So don't go into the room and close it behind you. That's Clarence Thomas closed the door behind himself, where he says, I got in for affirmative action, but you can't. So we have to really think about that as well. And I love what you said about making the place hospitable, because it's not just your place. It's everybody's place in that room at that table. And if I invite you to the table, but I don't give you any food, like, I don't want to be here.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And the last thing I'll say too, is like, even if you're not on the board of your local library, but you see that the board of your local library is all white people, go ask questions. Go be obnoxious. Like, channel your inner Karen. I know, Tyshel, you don't like when white people use that term, but I mean, channel your inner, like, where's the manager, and be like, hey, what the heck? Like, what's going on here? Why don't you know, be annoying. Like, you can harness that power for good. I think ask why that door is deadbolted. You probably have a lot, and I'm speaking specifically to white women right now. Go be obnoxious for good, you know.
Somebody did just ask me. Somebody I know asked me. They said, I'm going to South Carolina, and there are these tours of former plantations. Should I not go? Should I go? And I said, go. I said, you can go. I'm not telling you should or shouldn't go. Ask questions. Why is this like this? What y'all doing with this? Is the money y'all making from these tours going back to that community?
Mm-hmm.
Ask questions. And that's what...
Be a squeaky wheel. It's exactly good.
That's what they told us, what our guest, whose name I'm blanking on right now, told us in our museum episode. Yep. She said, go ask questions of the museum. So go ask questions.
Yeah.
Why does it look like that?
Yeah.
You use your inner six-year-old.
Yeah.
That says why?
you don't necessarily have to be in a position of power to make those kind of ripples. And actually, if you're not in a position of power, you have more freedom to say things, because what are they going to do? Fire you for attending the museum, or fire you for walking in the library and ask? You have more power.
Because I'm a concerned constituent.
Yeah. Your paycheck is not coming from them. Right. Mm-hmm. So you have more ability to say the things that maybe the people who work there are afraid to say. So go make some waves. And have fun doing it, I say.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, this is a great episode. So I just want to let our audience know that we won't be doing an episode the next 2 weeks, but we have another, our last episode of the season coming. I'll leave. You can look at the website. I won't promote it just yet. But October 4th, and then we're off. We've done 3 seasons. Well, you might even see us reposting some of our older episodes, because they are so good. Sometimes I go back and I listen and I'm like, thank you, Reverend Dr. Monica Joy Cross.
Yes.
Thank you, Carissa. Thank you, Adam. All of the episodes. We have so many good ones and so many good guests. So you'll see that in our last episode. Our next episode and last episode for this season will be October 4th. Yes.
October 4th. We'll see you all then. Thanks so much for listening. In the meantime, you can check us out on all the socials.
Yes.
You know, Facebook, YouTube. What's it called? It's not called Twitter anymore. It's called...
It's just... But you know, Elon Musk tried to also do that to PayPal. They were like, go away. And they bought him out.
He needs to go away. I don't understand. Okay, all right.
We can take a trip to Mars with Jeff Bezos. All right. Till next time.
Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye, y'all.